Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Tom Wagemakers.
And my name is Aga Bayramov.
And welcome to our 14th episode of the podcast, A Global Perspective on European Politics. And this episode will also be the last episode of our season, because it's almost the holidays.
And today our guest is Dr. Donya Ahmadi. She's an Iranian-Dutch intersectional feminist and assistant professor of international relations at the University of Groningen. Her current research project concerns the regendering of contemporary Iranian historiography through documenting and highlighting the crucial role played by women activists in the political developments of the 20th and 21st century Iran. Thank you so much, Donya, for joining us today. And our topic is today, protest in Iran. What's going on there? And Donya will provide us general overview and also comparative perspective. What's going on and how can we understand the protest from gender perspective or overall from outsider perspective, as we have a less source of what's going on inside. Thank you, Donya.
Hi, guys. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here. As you know, I'm a big fan of your podcast, so it's
great to hear this. Tom, do you want to start the first question or shall I start first?
Yeah, thank you very much, Dunya, for being here. Yeah, maybe we can start with a general overview, right? So what is happening exactly? It's been going on for quite a while already. Yeah, can you tell us what's going on and why this is different compared to previous protests in Iran?
Absolutely. A little bit of overview about this particular episode of protests in Iran, because as you know, in the past 40 something years that the Islamic Republic of Iran has been ruling, there have been multiple rounds of protests in different periods, sometimes with shorter intervals, sometimes with longer intervals. But this is, it's good to start maybe with the fact that this is by no means the first sort of outbreak of protest or of dissent, political dissent in Iran. But this time around, the trigger of the protest was indeed the political murder of a young woman by the name of Jina Mahsa Amini. So Jina is her Kurdish name. She was a Kurdish girl from the Kurdish city of Saqqez. And Mahsa is her Iranian name. And the reason why I point this out is already that kind of directs us a little bit towards the ethnic complexities, the suppression of ethnic nations in Iran, such that a Kurdish name of Jina needs to have a Farsi equivalent, which is the centralized language of the country, so as to be able to be registered in the National Registry on the birth certificate.
So ethnic dimension of this protest is also more present.
Is already present in the very frame, in the very name of this
name
young
of
woman.
Okay.
So Jina comes from the small city of Saqqez in Kurdistan with her brother to Tehran, I think for a family visit. There she gets stopped and picked up by this sort of organ that goes by the name of Morality Police, Gasht-e-Irshad in Farsi. If you want to translate this directly, Gasht-e-Irshad is more a guidance patrol.
The guidance for religion?
Yes, for principles. Religious purposes. This is, of course, a sort of anchor in the Shia Islamic doctrine, that it is, as a Muslim, it's your duty to amr bi ma'ruf and nahy an munkar, which is to guide for what is good towards what is good and to stop
what's not good.
What is not good or what is
according to their own standards.
Yes, exactly. This is what that organ, what that patrolling organ functions towards. So they stop her already before putting her in the car. There is evidence that she suffered a blow to the head and she got concussed. She gets put in the car, she gets taken to a detention center. It's quite an infamous center on a street called Vozara Street. We usually call it Vozara in Tehran, this detention center. And there's a security footage that she loses consciousness. She gets taken to the hospital, and I think about a day later, she passes away.
Yeah.
This sparked a mass protest, the latest round of protests in Iran. Because of the sheer injustice of this cruelty. I mean, this young girl, there's footage of the brother that says, please don't take her. We are guests in your city.
Yeah.
We're just visiting. Yeah. And but indeed, this is not, it was a catalyst for the movement. It was not in a sense, the reason why people took to the street. But already to answer Tom's question of why this round of protests is different, well, the protests have been going on for over 2 months now. Mm-hmm. They have been going on in bigger cities, but in the universities, which have traditionally been the headquarters for these kind of demonstrations and protests, but also in smaller cities. So what we're seeing now is a widespread movement that goes all the way from Kurdistan of Iran to Baluchistan, one of the most impoverished areas in Iran, an ethnic nation that has, for the course of more than 40 years, been branded as terrorist, as separationist, mm-hmm. and what have you, right?
And this ethnic dimension is very interesting that you mentioned this Baluchistan, Kurdistan, or maybe the Tabriz, the Azerbaijan indeed, part of the Iran. But I'm wondering whether there is also support from the Farsi people also for this, or is it divided between ethnic Iranian citizens and then Farsi Iranian citizens, or do you see all kind of support?
Absolutely not. I don't think there is any ethnic divide. There's ethnic mm-hmm. solidarity. There's transnational, trans-ethnic solidarity more so than we've ever seen it. So when we say that, when we include the center, so the mainstream Farsi-speaking majority, even though they're not majority by number, they're mm-hmm. majority by distribution of resources, mm-hmm. right, by institutional recognition and what have you. In the past, there had been sort of an undermining of the ethnic question, precisely because of the sort of disbalance or imbalance of power between the ethnic nations. Mm-hmm. But now this time we're seeing that Kurdistan has been on the forefront of the struggle since the start. Now the Kurdish regions of Iran, the Kurdistan of Iran, are perhaps one of the only nations that have been able to continue their collective politicized resistance. They have been some of the only organizations, political organizations that survived the Islamic Republic were the Kurdish political organizations.
Like despite all the oppressions.
Like Hezbollah Democratic Kurdistan. And of course, they had transnational solidarity beyond the nation state, the borders of Iran, between the Kurdish nations in Iraq, in Syria, and in Turkey. But what is also very important, and of course, as a feminist and as a gender studies scholar, I must say this, that perhaps what sets this apart more than anything is the emphasis and the clear prioritization of gender demands.
Gender demands.
I mean, these protests are happening tragically on the body of a young Kurdish Iranian woman. And this time around, it is impossible to say that Iranian women aren't involved. They've been on the forefront of the protests. Their gender demands, so we're talking about gender equality, more so than we've ever been doing this before. And we're getting also the support of our male counterparts.
Yeah, and I think that's my other question, because it's really interesting to see this gender dimension as well. And I've been following also the Iranian protests also in the past as well. There were some protests against this headscarf, the strictly using the headscarf, that people wants to be flexibility there, not you know, like, again, the police stops you that your headscarf is not correct, or this part is not good, you have to do it according to, I don't know, certain standards. So in the past, there was also protest. A woman took the headscarf and then in the protest. So the question is, do they get really support from also the male Iranians enough, actually? Or do you think actually it is more the protest of the Iranian woman against the inequality and religious oppression?
So do they get enough support? That's a different question, I think. I mean, do women get enough support anywhere? Mm-hmm. In the face of pervasive patriarchy in any nation. In the case of Iran, we are, as Iranian women, getting more support than we were before. Uh-huh. So we need to put this in historical continuum. We need to go back to the beginning, even before the 1979 revolution, where a lot of our very progressive political oppositionaries, which were very masculinist inherently, we're sort of undermining, we're sidelining the feminist question, the issue of gender equality. I mean, the discourse at the beginning of the revolution was, so what if you put a piece of cloth on your head? Mm-hmm. Even though there has been in Muslim countries, Muslim majority nations, there has always been a feminist problematization of the issue of hijab that has had nothing to do with women's actual bodily autonomy in terms of whether they choose to wear it or not, but especially when it comes to its institutional imposition or its institutional banning. So the issue of hijab is so politicized in my country that about 100 years ago, we also had hijab being politically banned. And the enforcing of this was very, there is the clear historical parallel between how the Islamic Republic violently imposes and maintains the dress code, and another state with a more secular presentation banned the hijab. So we put this in historical continuum, and we see that the issue of women's bodily autonomy and their choice of clothing has always been politicized. So in the beginning of the revolution, men, many of which were politically progressive, so we're not talking about Islamic fundamentalist ayatollahs, we're talking about the Iranian left, who were very advanced on many political fronts, on the issue of the economy, on the issue of foreign influence, what have you. But the issue of women was sidelined. It was deemed not as a priority.
Even within the left side of the Iran.
Absolutely. Especially
even
there,
the secular part.
Especially the secular nationalists, the secular left, the Muslim left.
Why do you say especially for them?
Because they were at the forefront. Because they were at the forefront of problematizing structures of inequality.
In 79, right?
In 1979, and way before that as well.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the Iranian Tudeh Party, the sort of extension of the Communist Party of Iran from the 19th century. We're talking about the guerrilla. So we had Iranian partisans that had active female members, that had female leadership even.
Yeah.
So you expect that the erasure of the female cause would not be so big. But now when we look at, and I want to push against this narrative of this is just natural progressionism, that it's been 40-something years, so naturally men have joined us in struggle. This is absolutely not true. This is because of 40-something, if not hundreds of years of feminist resistance on behalf of women, on their bodies, on their livelihoods, mm-hmm. that has now compelled men to realize that the issue of gender inequality is at the heart of the issue of social justice. And
overall, in every political parties, left part, I would expect this from maybe as a bias way, or maybe naturally from the religious part, that they are more conservative. Mm-hmm. But I'm really also surprised to see that even the left part is afraid to maybe lose their power to the feminist movement.
Absolutely,
or so there is this negativity towards that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the nature of feminists. But also when we talk about Iranian women, we're erasing a huge part of Iranian society, which are Iranian trans people, Iranian queer people, mm-hmm. who are facing compounded pressures. So the violence of hijab police, this is something that we never talk about, right? The violence of this morality police, or the violence of the detainees. Mm-hmm. The nature of the torture that detainees face when they're sexual and gender minorities is an entirely different story, right? Yeah. But no, the expectation, of course, it has always been there. But because the nature of the demands, as we say in intersectional feminist language, has not been intersectional, has not been interconnected. There has not been a recognition that economic class-based oppression is inherently gendered.
Yeah, and even it's good that you touched also LGBT and the queer rights as well. And then I assume that even their voices are more silenced than, let's say, the woman voices. Like, I would say, at least in certain countries, if it's called feminist movement, and then it moves to the, also includes to the LGBT rights, queer rights, some moral policies is saying that, look what they are trying to do. They are trying to damage our family values. Mm-hmm. Is it also the same strategy in Iran? We observe that, hey, we are, of course, respecting women, but they want beyond that. They want to damage our traditional family bonds. Do they use this kind of...
Absolutely. From the start. I mean, the right, and even some of the sort of people who claim themselves to be oppositions, they have been reproduces this state-backed mm-hmm. discourse that this is a revolution for women to get naked. Women getting naked, of course, being the emblem, if you mm-hmm. may, of an attack on family values, of
exactly.
moral or Muslim values, Islamic values, if you may. Of course, these are discourses that are also in tandem with discourses of when ethnic nations like the Kurdish liberation sort of fronts, if you may, rise to claim their political stake, their political rights. The discourse that gets used to disarm them is they're separationist.
You exactly.
know,
yeah.
They want to
Another
threaten
argument.
The sovereignty yeah. of the nation. And that's how entangled, again, that's how gendered, inherently gendered, all these conceptions of the border, of the nation state, of the sovereign nation are.
They right? like they want to divide us by using this woman. Is
yes.
kind of the idea like that, look, these
exactly.
ethnic minorities, they want independence. They want to divide the Iran and to maybe get irritation from the Farsi people.
Absolutely. So the sacred, sovereign, nationhood crystallized by the borders, by the drawn up borders on the one hand, and then the sacred structure of the family mm-hmm. on the micro level. And these are still argumentations that actually work. You know, we are all invested in them, not just in Iran, but also anywhere in the world, I think, when you start talking about, when you frame the liberation struggles of certain, especially minoritized groups, the framing of that as a threat to our nation's, I mean, this is also similar, the familiar discourse for us in the Netherlands as well, in the way it's used against migrant groups.
I mean, feminist movement is very new in Azerbaijan as well, and I'm happy that actually it is emerging, and it's quite sad that it's new right now. I remember one of the funny protests and sad protests, a group of female Azerbaijanis were protesting for more equal rights. And then the police asked, are you guys feminist? And then the woman said, no, we are just making a protest for the women's rights. And then the police said, oh, okay, just don't join them. Demand, like, they kind of associate this when you use the F word, like negativity, something is not there. Maybe it's also because of the not very good education and the good propaganda of police. Yeah.
The protests have been going on for 2 months now, right? What you said in your public lectures that you give, which are very nice, by the way, you say that the protests do not have a central figure. But do you then think there's also a risk that the gender component gets captured by other dissent? Because this started as a revolution for gender, but it could be that all the other dissent also gets in there, right? So,
and kidnap the main idea.
Of course. The hijacking of a movement. Of course. I mean, we as Iranian feminists and queer people, and when I say feminists, of course, we need to consider that this is also a very divergent and diverse body of activism. But when I'm talking about the Iranian feminist movement, I am by and large referring to the feminist movement that recognizes the centrality of the queer question, of trans rights, it's not trans exclusionary, that recognizes the importance of ethnic recognition, the recognition and solidarity between ethnic nations. Of course, there are all these mechanisms, power mechanisms at play. Yeah. So, of course, there are masculinist tendencies within Iranian politics that are trying to suppress the female question. So, of course, we've seen this historically in different contexts, especially in the context of Iran. When we talk about the Iranian constitutional revolution, the revolution that brought the parliament and the constitution to Iran in the early 1900s and the late 1800s. This was also a revolution that was by and large triggered by a gendered discourse. And that was the kidnapping and the selling of a number of young girls in Ghuchan, in northeast Iran. Mm-hmm. So what happened, and there's a very compelling book on this by Afsane Najmabadi, who is an Iranian gender studies scholar and a historian, where she talks about what triggered the mainstream support for the constitutional cause was the fact that Iranian women were sold out of poverty or in tandem with masculinist ownership of female bodies to settle a debt or a tax step. And this mobilized this discourse of our women are getting sold. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, our sovereign nation, our borders are also getting attacked by foreigners because the girls were sold to foreign bodies. Mm-hmm. This is what mobilized the nation to come for the constitutional cause. But after that, when you look at historical records, when you look at historicization, the names, the bodies, the plots of these young women who were sold was never written until Afsane Najmabadi herself brought this back to the historical discourse. So our fear now is that Jina becomes, again, the catalyst for a movement that
someone use it for its own benefit.
And also, when we look at the motto of this revolution, I mean, it's absolutely incredible how it's being translated and being brought to different contexts, to Germany, to the Netherlands, Frau Leve Freiheit. I mean, this is radical for any context, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we need to question the intentions, the intentionality of this kind of discourse, and whether this very discourse will then be marginalized to make room for more masculinist, more politics that are again deemed more immediate.
But how big do you think the support is outside of urban centers for the protest movement?
I think that urban versus rural divide, that sort of discourse that the Iranian government has had more support within the disenfranchised sort of rural towns, is unsubstantiated. I mean, because the Iranian regime has undermined and has suppressed
rural area.
Rural areas, farmers, you know, Iran had much more compelling farming industry than it does now. A lot of those lands, because of corruption and because of just bad management, policy making, has been sold and has been sold to developers. When we look at the north of Iran, these are farmer communities. They had historically been surviving off of farming, and they were making mostly rice, but also tea and other products. Now you go to those regions and all of those farmlands have been sold. But then again, when you look at especially ethnic minoritized ethnic nations, the way the policies have been targeted toward disenfranchising them and disenfranchising their political will. So when you look at the border towns, especially Balochistan, that's why I think Balochistan is at the forefront. When you look at the Arab nations of the south of Iran, when you look at Kurdistan, when you look at Azerbaijan, when you look at the north of Iran even, some of the biggest casualties have been in the north of Iran, in the Caspian region, where Agha is, of course, familiar with. So there has been not just a lack of resources,
but also investment.
There has been investment not going in there. There has been the economy is being heavily undermined by centralist policies and centralist favoring. But there has also been discursive developments to disenfranchise, to stigmatize, to stereotype these people, to render the Kurds and the Azerbaijanis as separationists, to render the Zahedanis and the Sunni minority Balochistanis as terrorists, to render the Arabs as inherently sexist, as inherent backwards nations. And these are all state-backed discourse, political discourse that has been maintained and reproduced so as to suppress these nations. And we have bought into them. So I think actually, if you look historically again, the main communities that have bought into this,
the rural people,
fundamentalist Islamist discourse, are not the rural people of Iran. They are the petty bourgeoisie, so the bazaari. And also when we talk about the issue of the hijab, because many farming communities or many rural communities, by virtue of women having to be out in society, they have not been abiding by the Islamic dress code. They couldn't wear the chador because it just wasn't possible. So there's so much diversity, but it has indeed been the petty bourgeoisie in urban areas that has bought into, that were the main supporting body of Ayatollah Khomeini before the revolution. Yeah.
I want to, Tom, ask the last question regarding a little bit, take it outside the Iran concept, because thanks you to, we covered the kind of this complex issue internally was perceived, but outsider, from a post-colonial perspective, what would be the maybe a proper response from the Western countries, international institutions, not only the Western countries here, but international institutions from the United Nations or other organizations for this kind of protest in Iran? How could they respond this, except for sanctions? Because we have, when there is Iran, the word Iran, then the next thing is sanctioning our nuclear weapon or nuclear development. So let's put aside that in addition to sanctions, not sanctioning, and because sanction is also a tool of the regime to use it and say, cover their own bad management, you know, like, it's not because of our bad management, but because of external sanctions. You know, we are good guys, but we are oppressed. What could international organizations and the West can do?
That's a sticky question, Agha. That's a question I struggle with, and I will tell you why. There is a mismatch. There is a missing link here. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, we have the state, the Iranian regime, which has been essentially unleashing the worst kind of violence, prolonged violence on its own people, under the pretense that it's an anti-imperialist people's revolution. The Iranian regime has never claimed to be an undemocratic regime. Mm-hmm. They have paraded around the world claiming to be on the forefront of democracy, on the forefront of human rights, ironically, even on the forefront of women's equality. That's why the fact that yesterday, or 2 days ago, they got voted out of the UN Commission for the Status of Women was an accomplishment. So there is on the one side, and we have to realize that the Islamic Republic of Iran has also employed offshore lobbying agencies. It has funded and it has supported and it has cultivated voices outside of Iran that have also prolonged and strengthened this discourse of everything that is going wrong in Iran is because of sanctions. I think we can just refer to offshore lobbying
actors.
Yes, actors and mechanisms that have strengthened the sort of offshore, let's say, legitimacy, the international legitimacy of this regime. But on the other hand, especially if we're approaching it from a post-colonial, rather a decolonial perspective, we also have a system of imperial neo-colonial power that is also benefiting from the sale of weapons, that is benefiting from an unstable Middle East, that is ravaged by fundamentalism, that also suppresses left, liberatory, feminist movements within the Middle East.
The Western bullets, right, that are used in this revolution.
Absolutely. Precisely, the regime is using weaponry that is sourced by the West. So there is an element of hypocrisy also when we talk about the role the West. And even the United Nations, you know, this Iran, it's not the first time that Iran is committing heinous crimes against human rights. But this is a regime that has been recognized in human rights discourse, has been validated by international agencies. But at the same time, while Iran has been sitting in these bodies, in these sort of international overwatch bodies, right, like the United Nations, it has continued to violate human rights. So it has sat on those councils, like the International Council on the Status of Women within the UN, and it has claimed to be advanced on the issue of gender equality, while at the same time committing the most heinous, sexist, misogynist crimes against people. So I think on the both sides of what is it that Western agencies do, of course, we need to problematize neocolonialism. We need to problematize industries, including the humanitarian industry, you know, that is benefiting from an unstable. There is so much money, so much profit, so much geopolitical power that is at stake in this region. But at the same time, we are now at a point where we're saying the legitimacy of the revolution, of our revolution, needs to be recognized, needs to be reckoned with by the international community. And in so doing, the international legitimacy of the Iranian regime as a democratic regime needs to be put into serious question and needs to be confronted. Whether actually there is something to be done outside of Iran. Of course, the main fuel comes from within Iran. The biggest price is borne on the bodies of young Iranian people who are going on the street and then getting murdered, getting kidnapped, getting dealt with the most heinous kind of violence. Especially now that the whole round of political executions are at play. I mean, what we're expecting now is a mass level of political executions. But I think it's the beginning of an
oppression.
Absolutely. And it's also the beginning of a conversation. For nations in the West, including the Netherlands, to be like, we need to take a firm stance where Iranian people are getting killed. We need to call the diplomats. We need to start. Will that amount to anything? I'm not sure. But that will surely be the beginning of, at least symbolically,
show that we are aware of it, yeah.
Absolutely. And officially recognizing that this is a revolution within Iran, and this is led by the people, and this is not, as the Iranian regime and their lobbyists offshore are trying to frame, just a complaint or just a protest or riots or whatever discursive games they tend to play to delegitimize these movements.
I feel like the West, especially the European Union, right now is occupied, of course, with the Ukrainian crisis, but also to save the Iranian nuclear deal, to convince the Biden administration and kind of to re-sign the deal again. That's my impression, because I also observed in newspapers, even Iran support Russia in the Ukrainian crisis, and that kind of media is silenced. Maybe one out of 10 news mentioned something very briefly. I feel like right now the political discourse on Iran is like, okay, let's make sure that we have an alternative oil source, we have an alternative energy source. We cannot make and Russia and Iran upset. So let's at least close our eyes on certain things and then make sure that Iran is on the board. Because that was my impression with the Venezuela, when I saw the Biden administration gave an exception for American companies that they can explore oil in Venezuela, despite the human rights and oppressions.
Yeah, and let's not forget that Iran is the second biggest source of natural gas on Earth. And there is an interesting dimension, it's probably beyond the scope of this podcast, but there's also an interesting dimension of Iranian involvement in the war waged on Ukraine.
Yeah, Shahed drones or...
Yeah, those drones.
Yes, the Iranian drones. Why are they... Does the Russian state that has access to the sort of military and warfare of the Soviet Union, do they really need to borrow drones from Iran. I think that's a strategic play for Russia to bring Iran, directly involve Iran in the conflict, and in so doing to gain leverage in their political influence over Iran, and also to hamper negotiations between Iran, especially in regards to the oil and gas and the Western nations. So when we're talking transnationally, there are so many other forces that come into play that at the end of the day are all hand in hand in preserving their own interests, preserving their own source of profit making, and in so doing, suppress Iranian people in Iran even further. The lives of Iranian people are not the biggest priority for international, unfortunately, for transnational agencies, especially given that internationally, death, falling bodies in the Middle East is a very normalized discourse. I mean, our lives are taking of brown lives, of Muslim lives in the Middle East is not an outrageous discourse. It's an everyday discourse, the way it's presented by the media, by even academic discourse. So
unfortunately. Well, Donya, thank you so much for this interesting discussion. I really enjoyed, to be honest, and I also have learned a lot today about the internal dynamics of Iran, and also how indeed the geopolitically Iran is also kind of dragged inside the Ukrainian conflict, not only oppressing the feminist movement in Iran, but also anywhere in Middle East, in Yemen or in Iraq as well.
And maybe we can end by asking you, what can people do to support the cause?
Outside Iran, you mean?
Yeah, exactly, like here. What can people do? Just maybe to provide some hope as well.
Absolutely. I'm thinking in the context of the Netherlands, and for our listeners, who are, many of them are our students here in the Netherlands. I think, first of all, putting a break on this discourse of the revolution in Iran being a Western-led, a sort of Islamophobic movement. This is not the case. This is a movement that is very progressive at its heart, as it resonates within the country by the widespread use of the motto. And the motto, I must say, Zhenjian Azadi, is a Kurdish motto that comes from the Rojava region. Mm. And then it's borrowed by the Iranian revolution in the current context. It's important to break this discourse. It's important to break the disinformation that everything that is going wrong in Iran is because of the sanctions. It's important to recognize this as a revolution at first. So politically, in terms of getting involved, there are all sorts of initiatives led by Iranian feminists, Iranian queer people in the diaspora that are in tandem with supporting the revolution in Iran. So find these sources, these resources. I'm happy to direct people if they want to contact me directly to such resources to support what is going on in the revolution. And of course, support your revolution by contacting politics, by putting pressure on local politics, on asking politicians to call the ambassador, to question diplomatic relations with the country that is executing people just because they're going to the street and protesting.
I think that would be a great answer.
And I think that, right, providing this podcast already helps to break the discourse that you mentioned. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
The points.
And yeah, so this is it for the podcast for at least this year, right? So we would like to wish everyone happy holidays and a happy new year. And we hope to see you next year again.
Yes, and I hope the 23 will bring more rights to everyone, not only in Iran, but everywhere in the world. At least the peace will be recovered, hopefully. Well, have a nice day and stay safe, stay healthy, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.